Okay, I want to welcome all of you to our webinar. Today's webinar is going to be with Alex Eiler. She's presenting on behalf of the professional development course that we're offering through the Polar Trek program. Today is November 8th, 2012. And she has a great presentation lined up today about her work in Antarctica and how she brought this experience to the public and to teachers that she's worked with. So we're really glad you're able to join us. Before we turn it over to Alex, we have a few things we wanted to let you know about. We're using a program called Blackboard Collaborate, and some of you are familiar with this already. But if you're new to Blackboard, the screen and the picture should have been changing for you in the center. And we have a list of participants on the left-hand side. You can see them and scroll through them. There's a chat area. The chat area is a fantastic place for you to post questions, share information, say hello, that kind of thing. And we also have, as we go along, if you have questions, you can click on the little hand icon above the list of participants, and that lets us know you have a question. It's like raising your hand. It puts a little symbol next to your name or by your name, and we can call on you. If you want to talk through your computer today and use VoiceOver IP, when you're asked to do so, you need to click on the talk button once, which is usually above the list of participants. Click it to open up the mic. And then when you're done talking, click it again to close the microphone. If you're joining us by phone and computer, you'll need to mute the sound on your computer so that you don't get feedback. Like all of our events, we are recording this, and it will be archived. And we'll share it with you on the website and through the, in this case, through the course lesson site as well when we're done and it's ready to go. So another thing we wanted to let you know about is about Polar Trek. So why are we hosting this class? What's the connection to Alex, et cetera? Polar Trek is a program we're funded by the National Science Foundation in the United States, where we match teachers with researchers, and they get to go experience field research in the polar regions, both the Arctic and the Antarctic. And Alex Eilers was one such teacher last year. She went to Antarctica. Her research team is currently down in Antarctica. I'm sure she'll talk about that. She was part of the Polar Trek program. There's a number of teachers that are going to Antarctica right now. And we encourage you to follow them along on the Polar Trek website at polartrek.com. And the next slide we have is to introduce yourselves to us as well as Alex, so we have an idea of where you all come from. So please type in where your name and where you're from, and if there are any other students that are joining you today, although I think most of you are by yourselves. But just let us know what interest in this course or this webinar and where you're all from. Again, if we have questions as we go along, you can type them in, and Alex will try to respond to them. We'll have time at the end of the presentation for you as well to ask your questions live. So with that, I think we are ready, and we'll turn it over to you, Alex.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys, and thanks, everyone, for joining. So this is kind of the second webinar of this series. Dr. Burns, last week did a wonderful presentation, really more about the science involved in this study. And so I get to talk about what I did as a teacher, and hopefully it'll spark some ideas for you guys to use in your classroom. So as Janet said, I was selected to be a Polar Trek teacher in January of 2011. And my expedition wasn't until January 2012. So I had a lot of time to think about what I wanted to do and prepare. And I heeded the advice of the Polar Trek staff when they said, practice, 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 and start your preparation early. And by doing that, I not only managed to get everything a little more organized, but I had more time to do a little more stuff. And so really the whole purpose of this preparation part was not only to spread the word about, you know, what we were doing, and really recruit followers to kind of follow along on a day-to-day basis. But primarily, I really wanted the followers to be invested in this journey and feel that they were a part of that. And so, since we did have such a long time, I tried to do some things, you know, kind of along those lines. And some of them were actually fairly unique. And you can see the titles. You know, we did a scavenger hunt. We did postcard. We sent postcards back from the poll. But a couple of the things were pretty unique. And we are going to start with the next slide, which will be Polar Sunday. And this is actually one of my favorites. But we have a, on our staff member here, I guess I should tell you where I work. I work at the Pink Palace Museum. It is in Memphis, Tennessee. And so I am not an actual classroom teacher. I am an informal educator. And so that actually ended up kind of being a positive thing because we don't really have just kind of a narrow reach. We've got a really big wide reach. And so, okay, back to the Polar Sunday. We have a staff member here who owned a TCBY. And so I kind of was trying to think of creative things with which to get people involved in. So we came up with the idea to create a Polar Sunday. And we got a list of toppings from TCBY, and we gave the students this list of toppings, and they had to come up with and create their Polar Sunday. So it wasn't just, oh, I want to put, you know, gummy bears on this because I like gummy bears. They had to have a reason why they chose what they did. And so it had to be polar related. And so on, I think the journal went out on May 1st and of 2011 and June 1st. And I'm putting all these dates on here, so in case you want to go back to my journals and take a closer look at those, you can. But anyway, there were two winners. There were probably 200, or I think there were over 270 participants. And some of them were actually very, very creative. And I put the winners up here. We have Alana. She came up with the Cozy Crunch. And she chose, they got to choose one type of ice cream and three toppings. And so she chose vanilla yogurt, and that represented the frosty snow. Her three toppings were hot fudge, and or one of the hot toppings was hot fudge, and that was because the warm layers that I would have to wear. And so they did all this after a presentation, so I'm really seeing that they listened to the presentation. Or she chose Oreo cookies because they represented penguins, and the chocolate chips because they represented the seals. In actuality, the seals look a little bit like melted chocolate on the sea ice. And then Josh's sundae, I think, was the most creative. His vanilla yogurt represented the snow. The Oreo cookies, again, represented the black and white of the penguins. Hot fudge was to keep me warm, but his multicolored sprinkles that you see there represented, he said the northern lights, but he meant the southern lights. And so I thought that was just fantastically unique. So the kids really got a big kick out of that. And incidentally, those two actually got their winning sundae. They got to get their winning sundae at TCBY, and so they're pictured there. So that was one of the creative things we did. Another thing was misconceptions. And we did these journals throughout the summer and throughout the school year. And so I went to numerous schools before my expedition. And I think there was only one class that did not ask me if I were going to see polar bears. So we ended up coming up with a couple of misconception slides, or what's wrong, kind of explain this picture slides. And the one with the penguins and the polar bear was kind of a what's wrong with this picture. And the students had to participate, and they had to email me why I would never see this picture in real life. We actually got quite a lot of responses from a little unique responses by the way the polar bear was positioned there too. And then the bottom one would represent many of the students that I worked with didn't know that Antarctica was a desert. Since it's covered with snow, we think of snow being as a form of precipitation, and there's a lot of snow there. But there's actually, it doesn't melt, and so it just kind of keeps accumulating, but it actually is a desert. And so that was one image that they had to explain. We also, over the summer, tried to participate with a number of kind of entities in the Memphis area, and one of them we chose was the Memphis Library Systems. They have actually, a number of libraries throughout Memphis, and they actually participated in some kind of reading programs. And so that was actually really neat to have them participate. We also did a couple of things called a fall festival, kind of like a Halloween type theme. We had some kids dress up in polar related gear, and I think one of the people who won dressed up as an explorer, Matthew Henson, so that was kind of neat. And then we also decorated for Christmas, Antarctica style, and there were students who submitted those, and those journals are listed there, so if you want to take a closer look at those, you can. One of the most kind of just a just for fun thing we did was what is it photos. So we posted the photos, and the top photos are the ones that were posted. The bottom photos were the answers, and you had to guess what the photo was. And those were amazingly popular. In fact, I was surprised at how many emails I got from adult work addresses. And so there's a lot of fun doing that. But when we started school, we started to get a little more academic. And this was probably one of the more unique things we did. We really wanted the students to get invested in what I was doing. And so we came up with this Antarctica Raw. Now, raw doesn't mean, uncooked. R stands for reading, A, art, and W, writing. And we would pick a topic a month and put those out, and the students could either read a book about that topic, do an art project about the topic, or write about those topics. And each month we got a submission for each one of those areas. So we started off with the polar regions, and then each month after that, before I left, we had an animal, because animals are very popular, we had an animal and a science-focused topic, science and or history-focused topic. And so the journals that highlight the Antarctica Raw are listed there on the right. And then kind of another just for fun one. This was actually very popular, so popular that if I ever do this again, I will have people send postcards to me in Antarctica rather than having me carry them down, because we carried about 2,400 postcards down to Antarctica, and I had really one suitcase that was just devoted to them. And so this is actually on the left. You can see, let me see if I can point, yeah. On the left, right by that star, you can see that's the tree we had. And yes, the tree is upside down, which I actually like much better because the ornaments actually hang on the tree rather than having to stuff them in the tree. And right next to that is where the students and or general public would drop their postcards in. And on the right, we've got a little spattering of some of the postcards that we received. And I took down, and I just thought those were, and I can't remember who they were saying. We were talking this week in kind of our online chat about cross-curricular things, doing an art project. I had really several art teachers work with, designing these postcards, and so I chose some of what I thought were, some of the better postcards. Then the biggest thing I did was kind of an idea that I called a closer look. I really spent the most time working on this. So as I said, I'm not a classroom teacher. My classroom is really the Mid-South. And I found through this project it even extended much further than just the Mid-South. And so again, I also wanted students to feel a part of this journey, so I really wanted to do some planning and organizing and a lot of school visits to get them to select. This is kind of a program we came up with. We called it Take a Closer Look At, and we selected a bunch of topics with which each class could take a closer look at. Now, this right here doesn't have all of the Waddell Seal ones on there, but we were doing this throughout the entire school year, basically, and so we wanted to get some topics that were cross-curricular. Let's get some history topics about the explorers and some weather topics, and of course, like I said, animals are very, very popular. Earth and space science topics, and just some fun topics about Antarctica. So some of the weather topics were listed there. We did some Antarctica weather, the weather conditions, condition 1, 2, and 3. We've got katabatic winds, wind chill. Actually, wind chill was a video, and that's actually one of my favorite. We went literally at the 100th anniversary for the race to the South Pole, so I had to include the explorers and a little bit of history in there. So we did Edmondson, we did Scott, we did a couple of journals about Antarctic firsts. Again, penguins are hugely, hugely popular, so we had a lot of closer looks about that, as well as the predators. And a lot of these topics really were organized kind of by grade groups, and I would suggest to the teachers what might be most appropriate for them. However, it didn't always work that way. We had a lot of varied age ranges in there, and so I really had to write these, or at least I tried, to write these journals so at least a portion of them could fit with any age range. All right, let's sneak to a closer look at the Waddell Seal. So I had talked to Dr. Burns and found out that we would be essentially doing the same thing 21 times. And so in kind of preparing for my journals, I was thinking, well, that might be a bit monotonous, saying, oh, we tagged another seal today, and we tagged another seal today. So she and I came up with a plan and a focus. And I looked at the curriculum and tried to focus what I was doing based on what most students were studying. And animal adaptations was, you know, one of the biggest things. And really, how can the Waddell Seal survive in such a harsh environment? So again, trying to create this cross-curricular, or this curricular connection. And we selected 18 topics. Actually, I'm going to sneak to the next slide. 18 topics, and I've listed all of the journals here and kind of highlighted the topics. And so Dr. Burns and I spent, you know, countless really hours on the phone kind of preparing to try and answer these. And so the students could actually write this topic in their little closer look outline, which was on here. They'd write their topic in there, get that topic to me, and I would actually take their closer looks right there on the bottom right down with me, and whatever object we were talking about, like we're talking about right there, the Waddell Seal's nose, and so we'll take their closer look papers out there, and then that journal would be basically sponsored by that class. All right, so what I want to do is highlight a little bit about what we talked about. Now, I can't go through all the journals, but I'm going to highlight some of my favorites. Now, I'm kind of one of those people who kind of has to know where the setting is. So if I'm watching a movie, I've got to look at the license plate or find out where we're kind of located. So I kind of did the same thing with the seals. I wanted to know where they kind of fit, you know, in the animal kingdom. And we did that in this journal we called All in the Family. Now, we did this standard classification for older, But this is kind of for the younger audience. And so when we get to the family, or really the order, we kind of dug a little bit deeper. So in this section, we focused on pinnipeds and the three different, you know, families within the order of pinnipeds. And so we had true seals, which are the Weddell seal, so it's right in the middle. We have walruses, and then we also have sea lions. And then in that journal, we actually focused a little bit on, well, walruses are pretty easy to identify their differences, but between the seal and the sea lion, we focused on kind of how to tell the difference between the two. And ears were one of the ways that they could take, you can find the difference. Basically, seals don't have external ear flaps, where sea lions do. The fore flippers and the hind flippers are different. And in fact, the hind flippers of a sea lion can basically rotate under their body. And you can kind of see that. Let me see if I can get my pointer here. You can kind of see that that actually rotates a little bit under their flippers, under their body, and they can almost walk a little bit. And I use the word walk very loosely. Whereas the hind flippers on, you know, like the Weddell seal, basically are nearly useless on land. And also the difference in the insulation, one having a little more blubber versus one having a little more fur. And so that was our all in the family. So the next one I'm going to go to is mussels. And I actually, honestly, I cannot go into a grocery store, into the meat section of a grocery store, without thinking of the Weddell seal mussel anymore. But as you see on the left side of the page, we have several meats from animals. So we've got a fish there, chicken here, and steak there. And you can actually see that they vary in color. And the reason they vary in color is because the myoglobin. So myoglobin is in the muscles. It's in everybody's muscles, yours, mine, you know, fish, chicken, beef, Weddell seal. And the myoglobin has a pigment in it. And the lighter the pigment, the less myoglobin. The darker the pigment, the more myoglobin. And so you can see this white mussel fish here has very limited myoglobin. This chicken has a little bit more. And beef has quite a bit more. Well, if you look down here to the Weddell seal mussel, it's a good image of this. I mean, this seal's mussel is almost black. So it has actually about 10 times the amount of myoglobin, or 10 times more than a cow. So that is just an incredible amount of myoglobin. And of course, myoglobin, the purpose of myoglobin is to store oxygen. And so that is what the animal uses then, or can use, to swim and hold its breath underwater. And really, these, Dr. Burns was telling me, and I really loved her example, that their muscles are actually very efficient. And this is actually in the journal that was dated on February 15th. But you can have organs and tissues that must have muscle, and that would be kind of like the brain and nervous system. If you didn't have oxygen getting to those areas, you know, they would die. So these are kind of must-have oxygen areas. And then the muscles are kind of, they would prefer to have oxygen. And so it's kind of a complicated process, but we've kind of summarized it on our journal. But basically, the seal is so efficient that they can kind of block off the kind of oxygen flow, you know, to the muscles. So the brain and the nervous system can kind of, they still get all this oxygen. So they're amazing, amazing animals. So if you want to read more about mussels, or the next time you go to a grocery store, if you take a look at that meat in the grocery store, this will remind you of that.
Hey, Alex.
Okay. Yes.
I love it. It's perfect. We did have a question. Julie is wondering, this slide and the all in the family slide, did you create these posters or is it student work? How did those come to be?
Actually, those, let me actually just slide down to, I've got a slide that shows all of them. Okay, so this is actually a slide that's coming up. This is a display we put in our exhibit. And it was based on really the closer look at the Weddell seal, how we were going to focus on all those adaptations. And so we took those adaptations and put them in kind of this main focal point of our mini exhibit. And so this isn't an exhibit that, you know, this isn't a, you know, like museum quality exhibit. This is in our education lobby. So it's you know, kind of better than, you know, the crepe paper type thing. but it's kind of what what our educators created here.
Thanks, Alex. Go ahead and continue.
Okay. Let me slide back up. We're going to talk a little bit about the blood. And what we did when we focused on this, you can see it kind of breaks it down into the age, you know, kind of levels. The basic thing we talked about first was what are kind of the parts of your blood. You've got plasma, you've got white blood cells, you've got platelets, and you've got red blood cells. And each one of those has kind of a job to do. You know, the white blood cells, you know, help fight off disease, the platelets help with blood clotting, and really we were focused on the red blood cells, and that's because it's their ability to carry oxygen. So we just did a kind of a real brief kind of overview about that. And then we did kind of a comparison, a volume comparison. And that is in, let me show you, this chart here on the lower left. It really just talks about blood percentage by volume. Humans have about 7 or 8% of their blood. 7 or 8% of their body is blood, where the Weddell seals, about 20 to 22% of their body is blood. So right there, you've got, you know, about three times the amount of blood that we have. And so what we were doing is we were really kind of comparing, focusing on the red blood cells. And the main job of the red blood cells is to transport oxygen you know, from the lungs to the rest of, you know, the tissues and organs in the animal's body. And we were taking blood samples to really see three things: the percentage of red blood cells, how big and how many red blood cells there were, and then the amount of oxygen carrying pigment. Okay, so the first thing, basically, the percentage of red blood cells is your hematocrit. And when I was preparing to go on, you know, my expedition, I went to the doctor, and they showed me, they took my blood. And so this is what my blood might look like. Actually, this was a team member's blood, but this is human blood. So you can see at the bottom here, those are the red blood cells, whereas you can see here, so that's the top of the humans. That is the top of the Weddell seals. And so they have, actually my percentage was, my count was 35.5. That means I have 35.5% red blood cells in my blood. The Weddell seals were between 50 and 70. And so it was almost twice as much. So that was incredible, incredible amount. And down here, this is the same tube, but they put it on this little machine, and I can't remember what this machine is called, and it spins it, and you can actually count the number of, you can count the numbers. So these pink lines right here are the tens. And so that is 60, and it's a little bit above 60. So this was actually, this seal's hematocrit was 63, and mine was 35. All right, now, not pictured on here, we were also, the second thing we were talking about was how big and how many red blood cells. And on the journal on January 14th, it shows kind of a set of two slides that have a grid line on them. And you can actually see the red blood cells. You can count the red blood cells. And so you can actually tell that on a human's red blood cells, they have a little bit less, but they're also, the red blood cells are a lot smaller. On the Weddell seal, they have a little bit more, not too much more, but their red blood cells are actually much larger. And then also, we identified that about 30%, or Weddell seals have about 30% more hemoglobin. And so that actually has the ability to bind oxygen in their muscles. So we learned with the blood that they have three times more blood, that basically 50% of their blood is made up of really large red blood cells, and about 30% more hemoglobin, or the ability to bind, you know, oxygen to muscles. So it was really one of the most interesting journals. And I know we have a lot of high school teachers here, so I thought that might be of interest. All right, we've got two more I want to take a closer look at, and this was probably one of my favorites. The teeth were incredible. And this is the only time I got a little bit nervous when Dr. Burns sent me this picture. I thought, we're going to work with these animals, and you can take a look at their teeth. You really know that they're carnivores. But they were actually, their temperament was very, very calm. But that's, you know, no doubt the first thing that sticks out in this picture are the teeth. And you can see that there are actually two canines on the top, two canines on the bottom, and then they have four incisors on the top and four incisors on the bottom. So on that front view, you can actually see that fairly well. On this side view, you can see that these front teeth, especially these large incisors, stick out quite a bit. And so I would take a skull to my classes and ask them why they think, you know, their teeth kind of protrude a little bit. And of course, most of them would say, well, it's good for grasping, you know, fish in the water. Yeah, and of course it was. But I think I sent a little worksheet or a video about this in our video chats about the Weddell seals reaming the ice. And they actually open their jaws incredibly wide and actually scrape their teeth along the ice, and that actually maintains their breathing holes. And we actually tagged the seal. I think the seal was 28 years old. And from the outside, from their fur, you really can't tell how old these seals are. But when you look in their mouth, you can actually see how worn down their teeth are. And in fact, the 28-year-old female that we tagged was completely missing one of the canines. And so that was an indicator to us that that seal was more than likely a little older. Also, what I wanted you to look at are these back teeth here. And this is the Weddell seal mandible. It is, you can see these small, very small, unusually small, I would say, back teeth, and they're called the post canines. They don't have molars. And so I got the kids, or would tell the kids to, you know, take a look at these and ask them if they thought they chewed and chewed and chewed their food like we do, and kind of had them, you know, use their tongue to kind of feel the tops of their teeth and then look at the Weddell seal teeth and kind of do some comparison. And actually, our teeth are much bigger, you know, in size than theirs. So the Weddell seal most likely, you know, swallows their bites a little whole. All right, so the last one we're going to take a closer look at. This is actually
nice. Can I stop you real quick?
Sure.
Hey, so Julia is curious, do the teeth keep growing like a beaver horse?
Do you know, I would imagine not, only because they're constantly wearing them down, you know, on the ice. And they all, what I saw, they all appeared to be about the same size. So I don't believe so.
Yeah, great point. With wolves, I would say you'd test out the length of their teeth to see how much work they've been doing over time. so maybe that's similar.
I don't think they have continuous growing
teeth. I don't think.
I think if they lose a tooth, that's all over.
Well, and that's why that was that
break one or something.
Yeah, the 28-year-old seal it was gone. Yeah. All right. Well, if you look at this eye, I mean, this was an incredible picture. This is one of my favorite pictures that we took down there. And as you can see, that little diagram, you know, of the parts of the eye. And of course, you can see, you know, the iris and the pupil in there, and you can actually see that slit right there, which was unbelievable to get that close. And I don't know if you can see, there is right here, the person who was taking the picture, that is a picture of his head, and his body kind of goes back towards the left. I don't know if you can kind of see that silhouette in there, but this is one incredible picture. But of course, you know, you can see the parts, little parts of the eye, so you can look at the iris, you can look at the pupils, and what we were talking about in our journals was really there's a lot that's similar about our eyes and the Waddell seal's eye, but there is actually quite a bit that is different. And this slide right here will kind of tell you a little bit about the difference. One of the main differences, besides they're probably twice as big, is the size of their lens. The lens in the seals are much more round, and so they reflect light differently than ours, which is a little more oval. And a couple of interesting facts. Seals may be a bit colorblind. So seals have cones, but humans have three sets of cones, and while the Waddell seal only has two. So they may have some difficulty seeing all colors, but the scientists believe that they may be more sensitive to the blues and greens of the ocean. They think that they know seals are very sensitive to light, and they have rods, and they think they're very sensitive to light because of the large number of rods, and so it's an excellent adaptation for seeing in low-level lights. And also, if you've ever seen, you know, a raccoon at night, and they appear to have those kind of reflective eyes, those silvery kind of lined eyes, well, Waddell seals do have this kind of lining, and that lining actually helps them to reflect a little more light on their retina. So they are well adapted to see in low light levels. And you can actually see in this picture, let me switch my pointer, well actually I can use this, right there, it looks like they've got, or it looks like the seal has tears, basically. Well, these aren't tears like you know, humans would have. This is kind of a protective mucus that covers the eye, and some scientists think that this may help wash off or wash out the bacteria from the ocean. All right, so those are the closer looks, or at least a snippet of some of the closer looks that we had in our journals. And now I'm going to kind of talk to you a little bit about what we did at the museum. And I'm going to highlight some of the things that I really think that might be easily translated into the classroom setting. And so the first thing, and kind of probably the most eye-catching thing, was really our photo gallery. And our area in the education department is downstairs. So if you walk downstairs, you first see this you know, passport to Antarctica and all of these slides. And we kind of captured a lot of these images from you know, kind of some, you know, Antarctic sites. So these were all kind of free pictures for us. So this was the first thing they saw. It was the simplest thing that we did, and it was actually very eye-catching. So I can actually see this going down a school hallway or something. Now the next thing, this was actually one of my favorite parts of our little mini exhibit. So what we did was we blew up, this is probably about 5 feet, I would imagine, maybe 4 or 5 feet. This map. And I remember hearing somebody talking about in the dialogue about, you know, where is really East Antarctica and West Antarctica. And what we did here was we highlighted 10 areas, and we kind of treated it like a postcard. And so we had, say, here's this greetings from, and it says East Antarctica. And East Antarctica is, here are the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. And so East Antarctica is on this side. And West Antarctica would be on the west side of the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. And so what we did is we highlighted 10 areas. So we highlighted the Southern Ocean, East Antarctica, West Antarctica, Mount Erebus, the Weddell Sea, the South Pole, the Ross Ice Shelf, McMurdo Station, the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, and the Antarctic Peninsula. And so each one of those has an image next to it. And then next to it is like the flip side of a postcard. And we addressed it to, you know, the Pink Palace Museum. But where we wrote the stuff, it was actually a synopsis of the area, and it was almost in a kind of poetic fashion. So in talking about these cross-curricular connections, you can really get your class to kind of research an area, write a little snippet about it, and in kind of a poetic kind of fashion. So that was actually one of my favorite ones to write, and it's actually the one that is probably one of the two most well-received areas. People will just stand there and read this all the time. And the next slide is about Antarctic exploration. So I went actually 100 years after the race to the South Pole. So it was actually perfect timing to highlight this. And so we have a long hallway, like most schools do, have a long hallway that you can kind of display this on. And it was so long, in fact, I had to take three pictures. But you also might, I mean, a library, I think, would be a good place to kind of highlight these things. But basically what we did is we started, I think our first date was in 1773 with, James Cook. And so that was going to be way over here. And then this cluster in this area that I'm highlighting, this is from 1819 to about 1814. And this is really about kind of Antarctic firsts or Antarctic highlights. And so we highlighted the first person to cross the Antarctic Circle, or the first known sighting, or the first to winter over in the region, or the first to get 80 miles, you know, from the Antarctic, and that was James Clark Ross, and he saw the Antarctic coast. It was about 80 miles away in his boats, Erebus and Terror, and those are volcanoes on the continent. And then we go from 1840 really to 1899, so almost 60 years later until we have kind of a rejuvenation of Antarctic exploration. And so we have in 1898 was the first winter over on a ship. In 1899 it was the first winter over on the land. We have Scott and Shackleton's first attempt in 1902. We've got the race to the South Pole in 1911, and on until we get to, kind of modern times. The first woman stepped on Antarctica in 1935. So if you're in a history class, this would be a perfect opportunity to, have the students do this research. And incidentally, I've already done all this work, so if anybody wants this stuff, I'm happy to share this information with you and just, write in the chat box or whatnot, and I can get it, or maybe I can post it on our little web talk here if you guys want it. All right, so the next part of our little mini exhibit was really more for kind of the younger students. So we've got our food chain here, a little food web, and that was just something we did in the exhibit. Antarctic Extremes is something we did in the exhibit and also on the journals. And This is, I call Antarctic the estiest planet. It is the coldest, windiest, driest, highest, and all of these extreme extreme events here. And so we just kind of highlighted a few of those. And there's some wonderful activities on these little things as well. And so that's in journal on the journal on January 23rd. And so going out, well, this is the last one. Sorry. This is staying alive at minus 55, and I think McMurdo Station, the coldest it's ever been was negative 50-something. I can't remember what it was. But basically, this highlights how you have to serve or what you have to do to adapt as a human to these cold environments and why each one of these, I've got three layers, why each one of these layers is important. And so we got what we call this little orange bag right here. It's an ECW bag. And it actually has each one of these layers in it. Now, the base layer is basically your kind of protection layer. It actually whisks your sweat and moisture away from your body and kind of keeps you dry. So that's kind of its purpose. So you do not want to have cotton on this layer because cotton absorbs sweat. And so you've got, you know, polyesters or nylons or kind of wools or silks in here. Your middle layers would be kind of your insulation layers, and those will kind of protect you or, you know, keep you insulated and also add warmth. Your outer layer is basically protects you from the wind. And this big red is incredibly, incredibly helpful. But not only do you have to protect yourself, this little fourth one here, which you can't read, is actually, you know, fuels your internal furnace. Excuse me. You have to eat, you know, and to give you the energy to kind of produce heat in your body. So we wanted the kids to always remember that. And they said, if you get cold, eat or drink. And, you know, that should kind of warm your body up. And so what we've done here at the museum is we have created these two what we're calling passports, and they actually go out to the schools. The first one is the ECW gear, the extreme cold weather gear, and that, you know, actually goes out to the schools and the kids can try them on. And, of course, we've got the gloves and the socks as well. And these boots down here were loved by all. The kids just absolutely love to, you know, kind of try those on. We also have, this is the outside of this kit. This is called the Waddell Seal Kit. And inside the kit, we've got some images of, you kind of recognize some of them from the slides. We also have a Waddell Seal skull, so they can actually see the teeth. Notice also the eyes. You know, the eyes are so... or where the cavity is anyway, are so large comparatively. And then we actually send an old VHF tag. There's some glue, and this is actually an old flipper tag. And so these the students in our area can check out. And, you know, if you guys, you know, wanted to check out a Waddell Seal kit, and if you can ship it to your site, I'm more than willing to share that with you as well. All right, and we talked about this one before. This is, we're not really going to go into any more detail, but this is the really the closer look at the Waddell Seal, so we, everything we were doing down in Antarctica. All right, so I'm going to briefly go over my personal experience. And the kids loved the fact that I had to go back to school. Excuse me, when I went to Antarctica the first, I mean, we got there at probably 11 o'clock. We landed at about 11 o'clock at night. We didn't get to our rooms until about 1 o'clock, and then at 8 o'clock the next morning I had to go to Happy Camper School. And so here we are trying to navigate our way as a team to find our lost soul who has not come, our little mock scenario, has not come back from the restroom and we had to go find him. We look a lot more organized in the picture there than we actually were. and I had to also do sea ice training and snowmobile training. And then if you were at Dr. Burns's talk last week, we're finally ready to go to find some seals, and we had to go look for the seals, and we did so by two methods, snowmobile and the helicopter. And when we were on the helicopter, we looked for large cracks in the ice. Obviously, we found one here. This is called the Big John Crack. However, it wasn't an area we wanted to land because there, I think, that might be a seal. I'm not even quite sure. But we've got these little black spots here on the white snow. Those are all seals. And we wanted to look for places to land where there was quite a few seals out on the ice. And then once we got to an area, we had to find the right seal. So the seal on the left is fully molted, and the picture doesn't do it justice, but it's a nice, beautiful kind of silvery, dark gray coat of fur, where this one on the right almost looks a little brownish, a little dingy. And so this these satellite tags we were going to put on cost about $7,000, and so we needed to make sure the seal was completely molted before we put this very expensive piece of equipment on there. So in this image, you see the team preparing the sedative for the seals, and on the right, lower right, this one is there. Basically, Kim had just given the sedative, and we're waiting 10 minutes, and this seal did not mind us there at all. You can see we're right next to him with the net ready to put the net on. All right, this is actually what I spent the majority of my time doing. This is this white sheet of paper here is kind of a data for the health assessment. And so we have the seal ID. I don't know if you guys can, let me get the, switch my pointers here. We have the seal ID here, and basically what I would do is I would put WS12 and then whatever seal we were on. So the WS indicated the Waddell seal, the 12 indicated the year, 2012, and then the 01 might indicate the first, would indicate whatever number of seal we were on. And so the first one would be 01. The C tag is basically the ID tag that is on the flipper. And what we would do is we would write that tag down, and then you could go back and actually learn a little bit more. There's a whole data list of when these seals were tagged, so you can find out how old they were.
Alex, do you mind if I interrupt?
Sure, sure.
Hey, this is Sarah. So two things. One is that it's getting towards the close of the hour. I was mentioning to people we certainly can stay online for questions, and we'd love to see the rest of your slides, of course. And then Jillian actually has a couple students with her, and they had a question. How close do the seals allow you to get before they start to move away?
They are really, this is a very temperate animal, and so they don't have any land-based predators. And so they really are not afraid of us for the most part, and we walked right up to them. I mean, we really did. Some of them reacted a little, were a little more skittish than others. But for the most part, I mean, they weren't bothered by us in the least.
Thanks.
Yeah, great
and
question.
Alex, I was just thinking, for those who weren't a part of Dr. Burns' presentation last week, did go through some of the scientific details of the study. That is an available archive. And then it looks like you're going to go into some of that science, but maybe just give us the gist of it, and we'll see if we have any questions towards the end. Is that okay, Alex?
That's great. That's great. There's
Thank
just a couple,
so
probably this slide and another slide that I really kind of want to focus on.
Hey, no problem. Go right ahead.
Very good. Okay, so right here we would list whether it's male or female, and you can actually see a question mark. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to tell. There is the crew, and we've got date and time, latitude, longitude, location. And this entire chart here, we will write down the information that we're measuring. And we can actually see, in fact, we've got this line is abbreviation for ankles. And then we've got pelvis. We've got umbi, which is the umbilical cord. We have the mid. We have the sternum. We have the ax, which is the kind of under the armpit or under the flipper. We have the neck, and we have the ears. And we would actually do USD means that's the dorsal. I'm trying to think. The ultrasound. We did the ultrasound on two sides. We did not do the bottom. We did the girth, how big around the animal is, and we also did the length of the animal. We have the length, we have a curve length and a standard length, which I will show you on the next page. But on this one, on this page, I wanted to talk about the mass. And we actually, in the middle picture here, we are weighing the seal, and this seal has, I kind of called it a little burrito. It's kind of a little red nylon kind of mat, and you kind of roll the seal on it and then kind of wrap them around it. And on this tripod, you just kind of winch it up, and once the seal is just off the ground, you can actually get a measurement. In this bottom picture, this is me sitting on the tarp, and I have to actually get weighed because sometimes the animal would tip to one side or the other, and I would be the counterbalance, and I would jump on there, and I would have to weigh myself and the tarp, and we would actually have to, over here, that's the tear, so I would have to, we're weighing what is not the animal, and then you subtract that weight, and then you get the actual mass of the animal. And down here, we've got the blood work. We took samples of whiskers, we took samples of fur, we took samples of muscles and blubber, and I was usually the one who took a picture of the photo. All right, let me show you just the measurements. These are the measurements we did. The first thing we did was start at the tip of the tail, and there is a tail in there. It's a very small one. We would get a measurement from the tip of the tail to the ankles, and then to the pelvis, then to the umbi, the mid, the sternum, and all the way to the nose. And we would kind of get a curve length. So this is, we lie the tape measure right here on the animal, and we get that measurement. We will also get, the standard length is actually raised above. So that's from the tip of the tail to the tip of the nose, and that is not the curve length. So we just kind of raise the tape measure up about a foot from the animal and get that measurement. And we also get the girth of the animal, and this is you use those same measuring points, and you actually just take a string. We call it flossing the animal. You start at the head and go backwards, and you get a measurement around the animal. And so this white cord right there has a mark on the meter mark and the 2-meter mark. And we can just kind of add our measurements and use the tape measure to kind of get a real close estimate of what their girth is at each spot. Then we also did the ultrasound, and this is actually really neat. So this depression, you can actually see, that's the depression from the little thing I'm holding in my hand in this lower left-hand image. The red line indicates where the blubber is, and this area indicates where the blubber meets the muscle. And that was actually pretty much less than 2 inches of blubber. And this is just a couple of pictures of us doing a little muscle biopsy and taking blubber samples. The next slide, we can actually figure out, this is kind of neat, you can figure out what the animal is eating based on analysis of the fur and the whiskers. So this is old fur, the kind of brownish. This is the new fur. And they basically grow at the same time of the year. So the old fur, you keep your fur, coat of fur, 1 year. The old fur, they've had it on for a year. The new fur, they're just growing. And you can analyze what the kind of the isotopes in the fur, and you can kind of, it gives kind of a chemical imprint of what the animal is eating. So that's actually really, really kind of neat. And the slides we have, last slide were just the close-ups of the tags. You've got the ID tag, the VHF tag, which is in the middle of the seal's back, and then you have the satellite tag. And one last slide, just to kind of show you a closer look at the satellite tag, the antenna. You can see the battery embedded. You can see the circuit board inside there. And then you've got the pressure sensor, which is highlighted by the blue arrow, the temperature sensor, which is highlighted by the green one. You've got a conductivity, kind of the black thing, and you can actually see the little hole that water goes through there, and you're able to test the conductivity or how salty the water is. And then these copper switches actually turn off, well, when they're underwater, it starts collecting data. When it's above water, it's recognized as above water, and it starts sending that data back to the Argo satellite. And that is that ends our presentation. So I want to thank you guys all for attending. Special thanks to the Polar Trek folks, and thanks for you guys reading the chat, because I haven't been able to read the chat.
No worries.
As much.
So, yeah, we've got some questions coming in. Julia had one, and we'd love to let her ask that question live. Go ahead, Julia.
Sure. My question is, how many schools did you work with, or how many classes within the schools? And of them, you said a variety of ages, and I assume that included high school. I was just wondering what the distribution was and how many. Thanks.
Sure. Great question. That was, we worked with, many. Dozens and dozens of schools. In fact, we had, 102 people sign up for our workshop that we had while we were down there, the live event. So I was blown away with how many people actually participated. But yes, we had pre-K groups follow and high school groups follow. So it made it a little challenging to kind of write journals with such a variety of age groups around there. Most of them, however, were kind of the elementary and middle age, and that's probably primarily because that's the main audience we serve here. However, we did expand that. We don't really get as many high schoolers visiting the museum, but this really created a lot of interest in the high school audience, so we were actually thrilled with that.
Can I just
Julia.
Sorry,
Julia.
Hey. I'm wondering what kind of direct contact was there with the students while you were down in Antarctica?
We actually did a Polar Connect event, and typically, if you're a Polar Trek teacher, you generally do, technology, if you're able technologically to do it, you do a Polar Connect event. And we did one towards the end of our expedition, and actually, I think it is archived. In fact, I know it's archived, and it's on my main web page. You can actually see that if you wish. But we did one.
Great, Jillian. Do you want to ask that question live?
Let's see. What was it? I was wondering if you visited all these schools prior to going down there, and you mentioned we. I assume you mean you and Dr. Burns, or you work with other people?
Oh, great question. Well, I'm not the only educator at the Pink Palace. I am the manager of the department. And so we kind of treated this as, kind of our own little project here. So I didn't mean to by the we, I meant, we did this with the whole team, and also the we as in my Wood Elf SEAL team. So depending on what I was saying we to, if it was related to the Pink Palace, it was the team of educators we have here. If it was related to the Wood Elf SEAL project specifically down there. It was probably Dr. Burns. But we did a lot of collaborating on this. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Julia.
Sure.
One more question right here from Jillian's students. The million-dollar question, are seal scientists looking at seal populations in relation to climate change? Are they increasing or decreasing? And then we'll go to Justin after that.
Okay, that's actually a real good question. There's several seal teams down there, and I know there is one group that does look at seal population. In fact, this group, I know we did a lot of talking about the physiological side of things, but this team actually had three components. It had the ecological side, it had the physiological side, and it also had the oceanographic side. Well, that professor wasn't down there, so she and I didn't communicate as much, but that doesn't mean that that's not an important part of the subject. Once we get all the data in, then the oceanographer side of this team looks at the data, and they can actually determine a little bit of the climate issues. For instance, diet is important. We were doing the fur and the whiskers to figure out what these animals were eating. Well, that may tell, or that will tell the scientists what type of fish are in the ocean. Are they big fish or are they little fish? And that will tell a little bit about the dynamics of the ocean and what's going on. Also, when they get the data back, the satellite does a lot of this oceanographic, you know, data, the salinity of the water, the temperature of the water, and they can use that to extrapolate what's going on a climate basis. So there are those types of, you know, our program and other programs do that. Now, related to population, I know there's some groups down there. I'm not sure exactly what their data is indicating. However, the last webinar, the webinar that Dr. Burns did, quite a few of the females we tagged were had now given birth to pups. So it appears that the population is not declining in terms of what else seals in our area. It's a very good question.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Let's go to Justin. He has his hand raised, so go ahead.
Hi again. So you mentioned that you had some high school students journaling. I guess I'm wondering if there were any kind of extensions to allow you know the older students to go deeper into the content than maybe some of the younger students would be able to.
Actually, you know, that's a real good question. And typically at the end of a lot of my journals, at least the ones that focused on the animal adaptation, I had like just a little going deeper section with Dr. Burns. And she would kind of review the journals and then, where appropriate, add a little bit. And I know, gosh, I'm not going to remember how many deeper ones, but I know the muscles, the lungs, the blood, the blubber probably have a little more higher level content. In fact, those I'm sure were in there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. You're very welcome.
Yes, go ahead. Judy has a question here.
Sure.
Alex, I've heard that wild seals are pretty stinky. How long did it take you to get used to approaching them and to working around them?
They really are. In fact, there was one team member, Linnea. She actually is at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. You know, the ice is a little bit slippery, and the seals, you know, they don't have restrooms. They just, you know, go where they are, and it kind of she had a little bit of an accident, and it got on her coat, and they had to launder that, I think, 3 or 4 times before the the stink got out. But it does, it's something to get used to, and then there's times that you just have to walk away. But they are a little stinky. That's just part of it.
All right. I don't know if there's any more questions or not. I'm waiting to see if anybody has is typing something or raising their hand. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Alex. So we got a couple people typing things. A very good presentation. For those of you that joined us maybe a little bit late and aren't sure what happens next, this presentation will be archived, and we'll post it on the website. And if you're in the class, we'll also give you the link. Give us a day or two for that. Yeah, probably maybe tomorrow, or yeah, we'll give it to you since for the class people so that you can review it again. And if you didn't get your questions asked, Alex, I'm sure, will be happy to give you her contact info. And I know she's been very, very active on our class website. Thank you for doing so, Alex. It's great to have your input. So feel free to ask her any more questions. And even Dr. Burns has been responding to some questions as well. So if you have things that are you weren't unsure about or Alex might not know about, you can email her. And otherwise,
And the Ask the Team is still open, too, the Ask the Team section on my journal.
Yeah, I forgot about that. So we did open up Alex's Ask the Team section on the PolarTrek website, so you can go there. And if your students have questions, that's a great spot for them to post questions, and Alex and the team will ask them while they're down in Antarctica. So thank you all very much. And like I said, we'll post this on the website, and we have some upcoming events happening from Antarctica. We have other teachers that are down there right now, and we're getting set for Antarctica Day, which is December 1st, but we'll have a webinar on December 3rd. So be sure to check out the PolarTrek website and sign up for those other Polar Connect events and see what else is happening in Antarctica. Thanks,
everybody. Sure, sure. And I'll post, for those in the class, I'll post my my information about the exhibits on that site.